Yes, good morning. It is Tuesday, the 25th of August, and I am, of course, sitting here with our co-host, Amy Maguire.
Good morning, Karen. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Amy. And
that's
yourself?
That's great. I'm very good this beautiful Tuesday. A bit of traffic around the place, which is a bit unfortunate, but
yes.
All good.
And as we're talking, Tiger, our regular host, is making his way up to the Gympie Master. So it's you and I in the chair for the rest of this week.
Yeah, but a lot of stuff to talk about. The Prime Minister's up Torres Strait. He was yesterday on Mur Island, where he visited the grave of Eddie Mabo. So a lot to talk about, particularly with our guest today, who's Dr. Dawn Casey.
All right, no worries. Well, I will get her on the phone while you do the regular introduction, I suppose, with the welcome.
Yep. Well, first of all, welcome to all our listeners all around the country and in the Brisbane area. I'd like to acknowledge the First Nations people all around the country and our elders, both past and present, and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners tuned in across the country on the National Indigenous Radio Service Network as well. So it's good to have your company, and also those around on the internet listening in through our podcast.
All right. As Amy said, Dr. Dawn Casey is going to be our guest here on Let's Talk. We'll have her on the show in just a moment.
And today we've got a very special guest, Dr. Dawn Casey. Dr. Casey, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Amy, and just call me Dawn, please.
Oh, Dawn, yeah, good to go. First of all, who's your mob and where's your country?
Okay, my country is around Croydon, from the Takala mob, and my mother's name, and she's passed away, is Myrtle Douglas, was her single name. And my father's name was Frank Casey.
Right. And the reason we got you on today, and it's actually quite timely, was that a couple of weeks ago you actually gave the annual Mabo oration up here in Brisbane, actually. And I think it's quite timely because we've actually got our Prime Minister up on the Torres Strait at the moment. Yesterday he visited the grave of Eddie Mabo and he made a few comments. When you look at the Prime Minister's visit to spend a week in an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander community, how do you view that? Do you see that as a gesture of goodwill?
Yes, it was very interesting watching the television last night, because I've actually worked back and forwards in the Torres Strait years ago when I was working for the Commonwealth Department of Education. Look, I think it has to go more than just spending a week in Indigenous communities. You judge people, it doesn't matter whether the Prime Minister or the Minister or people working as head of the legal services or in my role, it has to go further than just looking at them spending a week in places. It needs to go into more depth. And it was, for me, I think it was fantastic for the Mabo family and for the Torres Strait Islanders, that the Prime Minister, and there's been not a Prime Minister apparently, visit there for many years, because what that does is brings the media to those places, and that's important in terms of getting a wider distribution of the issues around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues. But if you look at what's happened to date, I think the turnaround of the Prime Minister on listening to the four people, Patrick Dodson, Noel Pearson, Megan Davis and Kirsty Parker, and changing his stand on there being conferences around the country is fabulous. If you look at the cuts to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander programs, since the Prime Minister's come to power and he's brought it into the Prime Minister's department, there was $500 million in cuts. Also, the changeovers in doing that change, I would suggest, is costing tens of millions of dollars. So, for me, I think the visit was fantastic, but it has to go beyond more than that. And, you know, it has to go into programs and how many outcomes and how much improvement are we making?
Yeah, I would
for
tend
Aboriginal
to
and Torres Strait Islander people.
I would tend to agree, and I think it was quite ironic that he was up visiting Eddie Mabo's grave as well. He's made a few comments. One of them, which I've seen being quite controversial amongst our mob, where he said Eddie Mabo would take on the previously settled view of Australian law, and good on him for having a go, and ultimately good on our system for being able to accommodate Eddie Mabo and the other plaintiffs' cry for justice. Now, this was a very long fight for not only Eddie Mabo but the plaintiffs, but also a man called John Kawada, which is someone who paved the way for the High Court decision. And it's something that you've talked about in your speech. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think I'll just go to your first point in terms of visiting Eddie Mabo. When the native title decision came down and the Mabo decision came down and subsequently the WIC decision came down, the Liberal National Party government were totally opposed to it. Totally. They were, the Prime Minister Howard was, you know, in the news showing maps, and Tim Fisher was declaring there would be bucket loads of extinguishments. So you're right in terms of what you were saying. I agree with that sentiment. I think there have been two significant issues in Australia's history that have made the profound difference for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and that is the introduction of the anti-discrimination legislation by Gough Whitlam's government. And from that, John Kawata was able to take his case forward. And now let's just recall it for some people who wouldn't have heard my talk. And that was that he applied to the Land Commission, the commission in those days where Aboriginal people could apply for grants, to acquire Archer River, the pastoral property from where his people had lived and come from. It was approved. It then needed to go to the Queensland minister responsible for those pastoral leases. They refused it, and it was refused absolutely on the basis that he was an Aboriginal person wanting to run this pastoral property. He took that to court, and he won his court case, and that was based on the fact that there was an anti-discrimination legislation in place. And so with that, Eddie Mabo and his other colleagues took his case to the High Court. The good thing about Mabo too was that they recognised that long continuous cultural and traditional links to the land, which subsequently resulted in native title. So, you know, I sort of, having been around so long, I suppose, wanted to draw to the attention of our younger Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders that here's what happened over the years. And when people and politicians and others make the, you know, statements about here we've had another gain for Aboriginal people, it's been fought by Aboriginal people that we have not been given anything.
Yeah, and even the use of the word accommodate is completely wrong, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Governments weren't keen to even accommodate Aboriginal land rights or any sort of aspiration around that.
Absolutely not. The first land rights, and I have to give it to the Northern Territory in terms of the Gough Whitlam initiated the land rights in the Northern Territory as a result of the Gurindji standoff. But Malcolm Fraser, to give him his due, continued as Prime Minister with that land rights legislation. Subsequently, we fought hard for national land rights, but then Bob Hawke, who agreed to it initially, Brian Burke, who was the Labor Premier in Western Australia, completely torpedoed it. Yeah. So it was never going to happen. And then, you know, then Eddie Mabo and John Kawada in Queensland, as you know, we've fought for a whole lot of things during a long period of time to no avail. But and what's sad about what we've seen in history of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander struggles is that it's a long, hard fight. We have the great support of a lot of non-Indigenous people, like Ron Caston in the case of Eddie Mabo and a couple of others. But, you know, then people aren't alive. Eddie Mabo was not alive.
Yep.
John Kawada was 20 years after, the decision to automatically turn his the property that he, you know, wanted to acquire and had the cash to acquire into a national park. So we lose so many of our people in the fight for struggles, and they commit themselves and their families, whether it's women or men, and it's really, really tough going. It's just you get, you know, I've known from my own experience, you see headlines in the press, et cetera, and it's pretty damaging. It's frustrating.
Yeah, and I think that leads into a lot of the trauma felt in a lot of Aboriginal communities. And I thought it was interesting what you talked about in your speech and what you just mentioned before about the younger generation, because particularly when the Native Title Act was actually negotiated, and it was the first time in history that blackfellas were actually in with government to negotiate this piece of legislation, it was not only was it about Native Title, but it also set up a land fund, but there was also a third part that was never agreed to, which is the Native Title Social Justice Package. So there were a lot of broken promises even in that settlement.
Yeah, that's correct. And what I felt strongly about was that a lot of our, and it's, young people do not know about that struggle for land rights. And I'm not suggesting that we should rehash history, but it's important that one knows the history of their families, which we all know is really important, and that's why the issues around the stolen generation and the issues around mental trauma and all of that. So the history of one's country is important, and the history of our struggle is important, because every time we move forward to try and gain stuff, rights and you know, just what we should have in terms of recognition, we need to be careful not to lose something in the way. Now, what was important in the negotiation for Native Title is, you know, people talk about the, you know, the $1 billion we were given into the land account.
Yeah.
But let us not forget that the rest of Australia was given certainty in terms of their property rights and their, you know, their land titles. So Aboriginal people gave away their right to, you know, gain even further through that settlement.
It's a continual compromising, isn't it, that we're forced to do as Aboriginal people?
Yes, and we shouldn't do it. You're better off, you know, you do have to be pragmatic in some ways, and the negotiators did an outstanding job in gaining that. They were of the strong view that there would be that third package, social justice. It's never happened. And what we're attempting to do as this current board of the Indigenous Land Corporation was to maintain the integrity of the reason why that land account was established, the land fund it was previously called. And then when I think it was John Howard's government made changes to it, they changed it into calling it the land account. What we feel responsible for is also that is locked away for future generations, and that the independence of the Indigenous Land Corporation's board is maintained, but they must put it, we should put in place good governance. The other thing that happened at that time and what we've been trying to change is it's administered by government, through government departments, and which is subject to a very, very narrow parameter for the return in revenue. So that's, again, discriminatory in that we've been seeking it to be transferred to the Future Fund, which is the fund which has billions of dollars of Commonwealth public servants' superannuation held. And their returns on revenue, for instance, if we could transfer that now, and we've been asking the government for over a year, by 2030, the fund would have increased by an additional $430 million. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars here. Just annually, it would give us an increase of between, I think it's about $20 million to $30 million. So it's just common sense stuff that the Indigenous Land Corporation Board for the last 2 years has been asking the government to transfer that across to the Future Fund, make an amendment to put in place strict governance measures, but maintain the independence of the board, which should happen for future boards, etc. And we're very concerned that, in fact, once we're gone, and I'll certainly be off the board in October, that it will be exposed.
While he was in opposition, Nigel Scullion made a number of public comments, particularly, I think, in Senate estimates about IBA and the ILC, particularly about a review and talking about merging them. How would that affect the what you're talking about regarding the independence of the ILC?
Well, you're absolutely right. I was asked to be chair of both those organisations to look at the governance, because that's been my background. And people within the organisations at that time didn't like it, so there were anonymous letters going, and it was clear that as soon as I became chair of the Indigenous Land Corporations, things were being fed directly to Minister Scullion, which were absolutely untrue and inaccurate. And he talked about we shouldn't be filling the CEO's position because the organisation, that position mightn't exist after he came to power. He, as soon as he was appointed minister, he called for a review of both organisations and asked should they be merged. Both organisations and other people put in submissions saying that they shouldn't be. And Ernst & Young, who undertook the review, found that both organisations had outstanding governance, and for the reasons outlined in the note of title and the ILC, they're quite different organisations and they should be kept separately. Now, that would still be of concern, albeit that the minister has said publicly that's not happening. He has said that it is on the back burner. The reason why some of us who've been around a long time, apart from or in addition to what the legislation set out to achieve, the ILC and the Land Fund is a compensationary fund. Yep. So it's not your normal run-of-the-mill program, but those types of programs have been together under the Aboriginal Development Commission, under ATSIC, and they become grey areas then. They merge. You see it with, you know, a whole range of areas. So the land account and the ILC is specifically for social, cultural and economic in terms of land acquisitions and land management. So because of the significant links, and everything about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture comes either from the land and the sea, we should maintain the integrity of that. Our culture is not going to change, nor should it change. And therefore, programs around that need to be maintain the integrity of that.
What's happening at the ILC at the moment? I mean, it's incredibly important for all blackfellas all around the country. As you said, it's such a significant part of that native title settlement. We didn't see a lot. I mean, it's been a lot in the mainstream media, but the previous ILC board, the acquisition of the Ayers Rock Resort a few years ago, there were a lot of questions raised that haven't been by the current board that haven't been picked up by the Abbott government, particularly. In fact, they've been almost stonewalling the ILC and refusing to order an independent investigation into it. But it's very important for blackfellas because of the effect it could have on the ILC and its future development, isn't it? Can you tell us a bit about the previous board and the Ayers Rock Resort?
What I'll talk about is in both organisations, when I chaired the Indigenous Business Australia and came into the Indigenous Land Corporation, I think it would be fair to say that The CEOs of both organisations had been around 13 years, and there was major change in during those 13 years, 14 years, in terms of the how statutory boards and boards generally around the country for the private sector operate. And I think a good example of some of those changes that were made was as a result of the asbestos, the Hardy Group, where there were judgments that found that board had responsibilities. Myself and my colleague board members initiated both in the IBA and then subsequently in the ILC, we were very concerned to ensure that we had a benchmark upon which we could be judged in our performance. So we initiated governance review by Deloitte, who happened to win the commission at that time. And even at our first meeting of the Indigenous Land Corporation, we just found there are a lot of unanswered questions about a range of issues. So the Deloitte's review found some things that needed further investigation. We took the Deloitte's review to the minister, as you're required these days to do, advise ministers of significant issues and decisions you make. And she suggested that there be a further, more in-depth investigation of the Ayers-Rock acquisition itself.
And was this Jenny Macklin at the time?
Jenny Macklin, yep. Yes. So that happened, and during that review by McGrath-Nicol, which has been published under FOI and comments made in The Australian and the ABC, in that letter to the Prime Minister, which I have to say was about the third or fourth letter we wrote to the Prime Minister about this issue.
And we're now talking about the Abbott government, are we?
Yes, yes. Because Jenny Macklin and the Labor government had gone by the time the McGrath-Nicol review had been finalised.
Yeah.
So that was provided to the Minister and sought that now it really required, like a former judge, to which gives them the provision to require people to answer questions. So that's what needs to happen now. I mean, there's certainly, as stated in the letter on the 27th of May, significant answers that are required.
Yeah. If you consider that this happened previously, it happened under the watch of a Labor government, the fact that Minister for Indigenous Affairs Nigel Scullion or Tony Abbott have refused to order an independent inquiry, I mean, how does that look to you? The fact, usually Liberals would be very keen to jump on something like this, particularly around a black organisation.
And lots of money involved too.
Yes, well, in fact, Jenny Macklin and Penny Wong wrote very strongly to the previous board and said they refused to provide a loan to the organisation, use a land account for doing it, and asked them, you know, very clearly to do more due diligence on the request. So I have to say to them, they were very, very strong on that. Well, I think Minister Scullion, well, it's clear that Minister Scullion had a relationship with some members in the form of there was documents that were provided that Minister Scullion and the comments he was making in the Senate was attacking new board members and myself and the new CEO, which was appointed. So perhaps that's why he felt he couldn't do a review.
A bit of a conflict of interest from Minister Scullion's point of view.
Sorry?
A bit of a conflict of interest he might have felt or to the previous...
Well, he needs to do... We've sought advice from him to advise or through the Prime Minister as to whether or not the Minister does have a conflict of interest. We've had no response on that. And the Minister would need to... He responded to the ABC not long ago that, of course, And I agree that opposition people and ministers, they meet with people who want to put their case forward about different projects. That's absolutely correct that they would do that. But this is a legal issue, so he needs to put in writing that he in no way was involved or promised that there could be a possible drawdown to meet the debt of it, not only with board members but also the general manager, and he hasn't. He's sort of generally stipulated that he meets with all sorts of people, and he did meet with, I think he said on ABC that he met with some board members, but he's never ever put it in writing, and he's never said it in Parliament, and he's never said that he hasn't met with also the general manager around this particular issue. Because, yeah, that and that's important in terms of particularly when he asked us for our legal advice, which... You can't just hand over legal advice like that.
You're listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM, the National Indigenous Radio Service. Dawn Casey is with us, chairperson of the Indigenous Land Corporation, and your host today, myself, Karen Durante, and Amy McGuire.
This is Amy McGuire and Karen Durante with Let's Talk, and our guest today is Dr. Dawn Casey, the chair of the Indigenous Land Corporation. Dawn, just for our listeners, I realised we haven't really explained how much the Ayers Rock Resort was bought for. I mean, it's I think they spent about $375 million of money.
Yes. Originally, it was bought for $317 million. And overall, there's been, and maybe even more now by the time we've added all the capital works that we've done over the last couple of years. I should point out that given that the Indigenous Land Corporation acquired it, this current board has been strongly supportive of the management and the board, and they are achieving profits on it now, but it's not at the level that was provided when they first agreed to buy the resort, and it's valued now at around $220 million, and we have...
That's a big loss, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of... You can't talk of it as a loss as such, but there's a big variation, and we have loans of up to $215 million. So what McGrath-Nicol advised, and in the letter to the Prime Minister... the valuation that the former board relied on was 17 months old and not updated to reflect the changes of the performance at that time. So so that's what we're saying. All of those issues that Grant Samuel has picked up and we've provided to the minister on the 27th of May need to be looked at. Because, as you say, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars here, and the ILC... was set up to acquire properties and provide land management, and it's had a major impact on our ability to do that over the last couple of years, because we have had to pay the interest, and because up until recently the Ayers Rock hasn't been making a profit. It will now be able to pay some of the interest, the majority of the interest on the loan, but the loan comes due next May. And that's $215 million.
Yeah, wow.
Which is extraordinary. And so you can see, and the Aboriginal community and Torres Strait Islander community should be able to see that this is just not some small amount we're talking about and we're asking for an inquiry about. It's tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting if you watch... the latest in terms of the Royal Commission into the unions. Now, I'm not suggesting for one minute there shouldn't be a look at unions, etc. It's the same with every organisation. But there's so much being made, and I'm not saying it shouldn't happen, about $75,000 that was paid to Shorten, Bill Shorten's AWU union, etc. But here, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, and we feel that the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community deserve answers to what is their compensation.
Yeah, very true. And what would the impact, I mean, I was reading in The Australian, I think it was earlier in June maybe, the ILC have previously said that over the next 2 decades it will have to spend $20 million of its annual $50 million budget on debt, on those debt repayments. How will it infect, affect other Indigenous projects, do you think?
Yes, well, it's meant that there are a couple of things. It has meant that we've had to cut back on our money that we've been able to allocate to programs. We receive between, at a minimum, $45 million annually from the revenue that comes back to the ILC, between $45 and $50 million to operate the ILC, acquire properties and provide programs. So we've had to cut back in the last year or so $10 million of that. So it does have a major impact. One of the things that we're saying, seeking the government's agreement to, in terms of as well as the governance amendments to the ILC, and we're suggesting that there should be an independent audit chair, that people's terms, because people were on that board also for some up to 14 years, we're saying that you should limit the, you know, board terms to 6 years, all sensible things. We're also suggesting, which we found surprising when we first came in, that Torres Strait Islanders don't have access to the land account.
Oh, right.
It doesn't cover the sea.
That's really phenomenal when you consider the genesis of the Mabo decision.
That's right. So we've been asking for changes to include the Torres Strait Islanders, the sea, in that. We've also more recently, because we need to refinance the debt, which is due next May, and even though I've now been told I'll be out in October, well, I'm keen to make sure that, and so is the rest of the board, that we sort out the refinancing of that debt. We've asked the government, could we have a one-off loan as opposed to just a complete drawdown and pay off the debt, but a loan, which would be at normal interest rates, and that would save $37 million on the debt.
Right.
But they've also not agreed to that.
It's amazing because, I mean, what you were talking about, particularly before, was trying to get the Torres Strait Islanders recognised in regards to the sea. That's part of the Stronger Land Account bill that you have, that the ILC have actually put up and supported by the Greens, completely knocked back by the Abbott government, isn't it? Which brings a whole heap of other questions.
Yes, we went to the government first, and we felt that we needed to maybe draw up the bill based on our experience of what we found with the governance issues, etc., and also concerned about, the possible amalgamation, because I believe it's still there, the potential is still there to amalgamate. It's easy pickings to find, use all this money, and also to include the sea in there. But the government refused point blank to even consider it and said there were submissions from a couple of government departments suggesting that it was discriminatory to have stronger governance issues in Indigenous areas. Well,
so they're trying to use it against us for once now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But they turned it down. So the Greens introduced it and called for submissions, and there was a committee hearing. And there were about 20 submissions by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who were supportive of it. And there were some really good recommendations made. And certainly the TSRA made strong recommendations about the inclusion of sea, as they should.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
In your letter, and it's been released under FOI, so it was a letter that you wrote in May to the Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, and it actually makes a lot of concerns about potentially in the review of the ILC, the Minister sort of taking more control over that fund, that it being subject to more Minister discretion. Should we be worried about that as blackfellas?
I think we do need to be concerned about that. We need to be concerned about that, not just based on the current minister, but even during the term of the Labor government, there were state governments around the country who were seeking to have access to that money to assist them with native title settlement.
Do you think they see it a bit like the Aboriginal benefits account?
Well, I think you just have to look at the... That's a good one to look at. That Aboriginal benefits account, yes, the minister has the final say on that. And what was interesting when the current minister came into power was there were whole lots of recommendations from the ABA Advisory Committee which were totally disregarded or overturned, and the minister approved what he wanted in it. And my understanding of the new structure of the IAS, for instance, they're all up for ministerial approval. Now, I'm not saying that the minister of the day shouldn't approve some things, but the ABA is a good reflection of how much control and how little Aboriginal people listen to. And you certainly don't want... This is a compensation fund,
yep,
and it should not be subject to the ministerial approval. Just because my nervousness is because we've raised so much concern about the acquisition of Ayers Rock that the minister might use that as an excuse to say, well, I need more ministerial control. Now, I think...
Because your blackfellas can't be trusted with money.
Can't be trusted when, in fact, if you look at this, this is... Yeah.
It's a really hard situation. It's almost in, like, you know, between a rock and a hard place, because you want an independent inquiry because blackfellas need to know what happened in that acquisition. But at the same time, we can't trust government to keep their hands off our own affairs and our money, can we?
And I'm sorry,
just from the history of black affairs.
The cynic in me is thinking they're looking at that bucket of money and thinking, well, that can pay for health, that can pay for education, and a lot of the... you know, the services that governments should be paying for.
Yes, no, that's right. And the other one, we've had experience that suggestions that we might acquire a couple of properties in the Northern Territory and do special drawdowns for that. Now, we are very... So it was a very difficult decision for us to go public... to go to the minister with recommendations about changing the act, because it is, it just becomes vulnerable. But how could we keep quiet and not pursue this inquiry and not pursue amendments to the act based on what is available in that letter of the 27th of May? Now, the minister and Cormann had sort of agreed, and then he chatted with Scully and then overturned, you know, or... you know, just said, no, there's no need for an inquiry, because some previous board members have done their own inquiry called the Aegis Report, which none of us has seen despite us asking for it.
Wow.
And it just did not have access to all the files that McGrath-Nichols and others have had access to.
And that's Scullion's excuse, isn't it, that they've already been inquiries?
Yes, there's been numerous, but it's just simply not true. There has only been one independent investigation, and that's McGrath-Nichols, who found all of these other questions that need to be answered. But going back to the point of, yes, it's vulnerable, the land account, and... why, if we've got Commonwealth Public Servant superannuation sitting in the Future Fund and protected, why can't we do that with Aboriginal money that was is compensation for part dispossession, et cetera? Why can't we have it, is my question. It's simple.
Yeah, very true. And so I guess coming back to what we were talking about at the start, when you look at Tony Abbott and Scullion up in the Torres Strait visiting Mer Island, and you consider that they're just not willing to even look at a fundamental part of the native title settlement and try and protect it for blackfellas or are open-minded and talking to the ILC. I mean, how do you see that? There's an inconsistency in that, isn't it, that they're up there for a photo opportunity, but at the same time blackfellas are being left in the dark around something so important to us?
Well, it was interesting because I was watching it on the television last night and I was really, really torn about it because I have an enormous regard for the Mabo family, and I knew Koiki Mabo and Passy and all, you know, many other people. And I know Gail, she's on the NASDA board with me. And like I said, it's fantastic because the media will follow the Prime Minister, and so they will see, hopefully they'll look more in depth at some of the issues that the Torres Strait Islander people raise, and they will question why can't the sea and the Torres Strait Islanders be covered in the land account as opposed to just the nice, lovely pictures of Tony Abbott laying a wreath. And saying that this is the first Prime Minister that's been up there in years. They've got a investigative journalism like you've been doing this morning is incredibly important for Indigenous people, not this superficial, show that we see in a range of areas, quite frankly.
Very true. And we'll just take a short break very quickly and we'll be back for the last 10 minutes with Dawn.
You're listening to Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service at 98.9 FM. Karen Durandy with you. My co-host is Amy Maguire, and we are speaking with Dr. Dawn Casey from the Indigenous Land Council.
Dawn, just going back to your recent Mabo oration, when we look at native title, and we've seen all across the country how devastating it can be to a lot of Aboriginal communities, how do you see native title in its current form and the current way the Abbott government has been talking about it, particularly in the Northern Development Paper?
Look, I have to say that I haven't read entirely that Northern Development Paper, but native title, I think native title is incredibly important. I think, yes, there are some issues. It was a negotiated settlement, so the Native Title Act is there. I think there are some issues that people are concerned about, but I have to say I would be wary about changing it too much because there have been some significant improvements and you know, people have achieved amazing things. If we're talking about property rights and land issues where native title impedes economic development, I think there's too much misinformation around about that.
Yep. Particularly in Queensland with home ownership and the legislation Newman passed, opening up home ownership in Dogit lands.
Yes, well, I just think people need to be... you can do home ownership without disturbing your native title. I think you just... you've got to be very careful. People just need to be very, very careful about thinking freehold is going to solve their issues, because freehold can, in the end, result in Aboriginal people losing land, which has been hard fought. So look at the whole range. Get absolutely the best legal advice you can get. Don't... I think we caught up with some of our mother caught up with his property rights in terms of what the white property rights are for white
and
Australians or other Australians.
That's the problem, isn't it? You've got two competing ideologies here. You've got Indigenous ideology and their view about land, and you've got the Western who view land as an asset, not
as
a commodity that can be traded and done with whatever. And
that you're absolutely right, Karen, around that. And that's why I just felt it was important to keep reminding our younger people who wouldn't, you know, in urban areas and even our younger ones from rural and remote areas who were going off to colleges and or even in their communities are being talked about. And yet here I am so sick of hearing politicians of all sorts of ilk saying that we're land rich and dirt poor.
Yeah.
It's just now got into the psyche of the broader Australian community. And, of course, we're poor, but many of the remote communities and rural communities and other areas deserve the infrastructure that every other Australian has in the place. And that should be given and provided as citizens of this country. So we need to separate out that, and we need to stop people from talking about these throwaway lines of, you know, land rich and dirt poor. What we've been doing on the Indigenous Land Corporation over the last couple of years has been giving a priority to making land more productive, because people years ago also acquired pastoral properties, not only through the Aboriginal Land Corporation, but the Development Commission or other ministers have handed over properties, but there hasn't been the money to go with and the capacity building to making that land productive. I just strongly value people staying on their lands where they want to, be conscious about, as you say, Karen, not just talking about in white people's terms, property rights. There are opportunities in terms of, let me show you one example. In the Northern Territory, very remote part of the Northern Territory, the ILC acquired, in partnership with the Conservancy Foundation, Fish River Station, and we're now carbon trading.
Right, yeah. A whole new economy out there, yeah.
A whole new economy where people live. There's all the pastoral properties. We've taken an integrated approach. We've been asked to go into some pastoral properties and not owned by the ILC, and assist them with training of young stockmen. We are doing training to ensure that there's a range of Aboriginal people who are managers on cattle stations. We've got a big sheep property that we're hoping soon to divest in Tasmania. That was the other issue, is that part of the role of the ILC was to acquire property and divest. So that was a big issue around Ayers Rock. It's such a huge, the one investment to divest to one to community. But for instance, just going back to your point about native title as well, we acquired a property for Victorian community, Zhajarang, and with that, the Victorian government in a native title settlement has given them national parks, et cetera, so they've got a whole lot of range of programs. I think the decision over a year ago about native title in Stradbroke Island was fabulous.
Mm.
And who would have thought, you know, 20 years ago that the Stratty mob would win that case,
yeah,
just in terms of if you were out there in the broader community. And that offers them commercial opportunities with a camping ground, which they're now working on. The Noongar settlement in Western Australia has been, you know, some people would argue that not everyone's happy with it, but it's been an extraordinary settlement, that. So I just think there are amazing things that we can do with our land, returning money from an economy, esteem to people in areas, at the same time maintaining our culture. We need to put a lot of money into capacity building, and the government needs to put money into infrastructure, which they should do anyway.
At least the Prime Minister for Infrastructure as well as the Prime Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, isn't he? But we haven't seen a lot of that. But thank you so much for that, Dr. Dawn Casey, Chair of the ILC, and hopefully talk to you more in the future.
Because
I think it's a big question,
ends,
yeah, a lot of questions that have to be raised.
Thank you so much. Amy Maguire, we are wrapping up Let's Talk for today. And, of course, we'll be back tomorrow here on Let's Talk with John Altman.